As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
Hello, my name is Zoe, and today we will be talking about sexual assault on university and college campuses in North America. You are listening to Lady Radio. Due to the content of today's episode, I would like to give a trigger warning to survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse. The material we are discussing today, as well as some of the songs we will be playing, can be re-traumatizing for folks. And we hope that any survivors who may be listening will do what they need to do to take care of themselves. WAVA has a crisis line. It's 604-255-6228. And the Rape Relief Center has one as well, 604-872-8212. As we discuss issues of sexual assault today, I would like to keep in mind that although the majority of violence is done to women, we recognize that all genders are affected by sexualized violence. Rape culture affects everyone. Sexual assault is about an abuse of power. That's why it affects race, class, age, ability, sexuality, and gender. However, given last night's screening of The Hunting Ground and the recent events at UBC involving the six female victims making their complaints public, our discussion today will be centered on women. Before we begin, I would like to provide a definition of rape culture. Emily Buchwald, in her book Transforming a Rape Culture, defines rape culture as a complex set of beliefs that encourage male sexual aggression and supports violence against women. It's a society where violence is seen as sexy and sexuality is seen as violent. In a rape culture, women perceive a continuum of threatened violence that ranges from sexual remarks to sexual touching to rape itself. A rape culture condones physical and emotional terrorism against women as the norm. In a rape culture, both men and women assume the sexual violence is a fact of life. However, much of what we accept as inevitable is in fact the expression of values and attitudes that can change. Again, this definition is problematic in its gendered terms. Right after our song break, we will be talking with Marina Clausen. She is here with us today, and Callie will be interviewing her. She is a former WAVA volunteer and a fifth-year student at UBC, majoring in interdisciplinary studies with a focus in gender studies.
It's not like I'm feeling much different than a woman my age years ago. Liberate is what you wanna call it. How about I'm fairly choked? Cause I know some just see my body, and every girl I know at some point stopped eating. I'm not a man hater, I enjoy them like. But in my position, I'm the slut, I'm the bitch, I'm the whore, the one you hate. And there's a name for this kind of man, a soft one at that, womanizing, casting over the theory. For us, it's just a stamp to the head. For them, another notch in the bed. It's like I'm wearing red, and if I am, you feel you the right to touch me. My lead, don't make me scared. Think you can have it.
And I'm Graham of the Stumblers Inn.
You are listening to CITR.
Oh, Vancouver's best music. All right.
Did you hear? CITR is putting on a full day of content dedicated to students. December 2nd is 24 hours of student power. Clubs, bands, radio, oh my. CITR constantly works to promote underrepresented voices in media. And for one day a year, we dedicate an entire day to focus on students. That means student hosts, clubs, initiatives, artists, and more. Featuring three student bands from 6 to 9 p.m. Melt, Cheap Flavor, and Stefana Fertilla. Listen up this December 2nd at 101.9 FM or at CITR.ca.
Hi, this is Callie, and I'm with Marina Klassen, and we're going to talk about Wava. Also, by the way, you guys just heard Braids' new song, Miniskirt. So Wava stands for Women Against Violence Against Women. And so, Marina, what does this service provide?
Okay, so Wava is a feminist women's organization that takes many approaches to how we confront this justice issue. So it's a sexual assault support service that provides emotional support through a 24-hour crisis line, as well as through in-person one-to-one counseling, as well as group counseling. And the second part of this comes within also medical support as well as criminal justice support for navigating those systems if that's how you choose to address sexual assault. And alongside this, they also have a public education and community development aspect, which focuses on understanding rape culture and sexual assault and how it affects us.
Awesome. And I know that we found out that the number we gave earlier was the office line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to clarify, for anyone that is listening and needs someone to talk through experiences, anything that's been triggered for them, or anyone in the future that needs to access WAVA support services, the 24-hour crisis line is 604-255-6344.
Great. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what would you say has been the most meaningful part of your work with WAVA? Or what, mm-hmm. yeah, what has been like the most meaningful and like important to you?
Well, a big part of WAVA is the fact that it's a women's organization working for women. So part of that is recognizing the fact that this is something that we are all affected by. And this is a lived experience that many of us can identify with, or many of us have witnessed or on the spectrum of what sexual assault and sexual violence is. And also all of us are living in rape culture. So we have exposure to this. So part of the meaningful work of getting involved in addressing sexual assault within our society is acknowledging that you are part of this system as well, and we need to hold each other up and support each other and work to dismantle systems of violence that are affecting us. And so the most meaningful part has definitely been engaging and learning from that, and learning how to also care for fellow women. So,
right. And like sort of going into that, how do you think we as a society and culture can help women feel supported and safe? And
well, I mean, there's many avenues for that. Every woman who has experienced sexual assault will have different ways of coping and facing that experience and that trauma, whether that be through finding justice through a criminal justice system, or whether that be through just getting emotional support to be able to make it through a day, whether that means like turning their energy towards advocacy and support against rape culture or whatever that may be. What we're really focusing on is bringing agency back to women so that they have choices in how they approach this experience and how they approach the healing process. And I think the biggest focus of WAVA is bringing that agency back to the woman so that she can make decisions about where her life will go forward from there. And that's really the focus, is supporting women to do what they want. So.
Awesome. Well, mm-hmm. it sounds like an amazing service. I know I have some friends who have been a part of it and really, really liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. It's really helped them through their process. Mm-hmm. So how, as this community or Vancouver community, can we support WAVA either by volunteering or like donating, or what can we do?
Yeah, well, WAVA is a community organization that runs on very little government funding, so donating would be a great idea. WAVA unfortunately has a really long wait list for people to do individual counseling because there is just very little resources, and this is not recognized as a service that needs the amount of support that it does, and especially because we're dealing with like such higher numbers of women within society that are facing this experience. We definitely need funding, and that can come in the form of like an independent organized fundraiser, which is something mm-hmm. that WAVA really encourages, or individual donations, which you can make to WAVA like online or through their office, and their office number is 604-255-6228. Another option is by getting involved, whether that be through WAVA volunteering or joining another anti-violence organization, and this could mean like just like educating people about what you know about rape culture, or mm-hmm. like consciously attempting to organize on campuses where, as we're talking about today, there's a large number of people that are facing these violences. And I think a huge part of this process is just breaking the silence, because it's such a stigmatized sexual assault is so stigmatized, and because we're all carrying like this shame of having to deal and interact with such a brutal form of violence, it's very hard to confront it. And when there's safe community spaces where that can take place, or and you can be an agent of creating those spaces, that can be a really positive thing. So
yeah, definitely like opening the dialogue about sexual assault and even about resources like WAVA, I think if they we can get WAVA as much mm-hmm. visibility as possible.
And also making like institutional spaces totally. Be spaces that we can talk about these issues, because as we've seen here at UBC, we do not have a safe environment for people to talk about sexual assault. In fact, people are shamed away from talking about sexual assault and from reporting, and the university is very unwilling to acknowledge the pervasiveness of this issue on campus. I think a huge part of that is that we don't have enough of a dialogue on campus about it, and we don't have an official sexual assault policy on campus.
Right. Which is huge.
Mm-hmm. And we're not addressing also the myriad of ways that, like, we can support women, whether that be through any, like, healing individual therapy or through any justice action. The school is just, like, passing this by, and the fact that this is affecting so many women in our space is just, it's horrifying. So
yeah, if there's not a system to deal with it every single time, then there is no policy, and that's not, like, it just isn't gonna work. Like, I know we have SASC, so on campus,
which is
about
a great
SASC?
Great thing. Yeah. And actually WAVA was part of starting SASC, so that was, it's been a, WAVA's actually been around since the 70s, so there's, like, a long history of women working to change spaces and make it more available, and I totally recommend that people access SASC on campus. That's a great idea, as well as WAVA services. I'm glad those things exist, but they're just, like, they can only do so much unless we have larger systems of support. And also, just for, like, beyond just organizing and groups, we really need, like, this to be a societal dialogue, and recognizing that it's institutional and that it's systemic, and that this is a power issue, and that it is so widespread, not isolated.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, speaking to more resources, do you have any more that you recommend for women or anyone to go check out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because there's so many resources across the city when it comes to women's resources, I would really recommend just calling the 24-hour crisis line. So I'll just repeat that number one more time, 604-255-6344. So the crisis line can connect people with services, whether it be connecting them to find shelter if they're in a situation that is vulnerable, or whether that be connecting someone to food resources, to justice support, to medical support, whatever that may be. WAVA is definitely a great place to start if you just have questions. And there are well-trained emotional support workers on the line that are able to guide you through that process, because it's really, really terrifying to go through the first moment of speaking that experience out loud. And so to have someone there that can really hold you in your pain and, like, sit with you and be there with you, as well as provide you with, like, practical assistance, is a really great thing. And unfortunately, it's a rare thing. So WAVA.
Totally, like, holding the space for you to access your feelings enough to figure out your next step.
Yeah, and figure out what is right for you for the next step. Like I said, like, bringing power back to the person, because so much agency has been taken away during that experience of violence, like, giving the survivor that agency back and allowing them to make decisions about how they best see their future.
Totally. So the last thing I want to talk to you about is, I know that looking at the WAVA's website mandate, it talks about support, healing, and prevention as their goals. So what are the projects that you've liked or been interested in that WAVA has done on education for prevention?
Okay, so WAVA has an amazing outreach program where they do workshops at schools. at schools, at institutions, like, of all sorts, including, like, medical centers, and they actually have trained people at the Sexual Assault Center at the Vancouver Hospital. So they've trained people there to do intake for people that have gone through experience of sexual assault, so they're not facing doctors that don't understand the whole breadth of what this experience is for a woman, for anyone who comes in. So there's, I think the biggest thing is that if you're an institution or a group or a community or even an individual who wants to learn more, they have a large number of resources, and they have well-trained staff that can explain the depths of what rape culture means to communities. I think it's a really good idea to bring them into classrooms, especially. So I would really recommend if any university professors or high school teachers or whatever it may be, to, like, really try and get resources like WAVA into your space so that you're providing education about what's out there and how to address rape culture early on.
Yeah, that's an amazing. Well, this is clearly an amazing resource. I'm so glad we were able to talk about it. Thank you so much, Marina.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah. Thank you.
No problem. Next, we're going to have a song by MIA called Borders, referencing the Syrian refugees. And then we're going to have a discussion around university and sexual assault.
Freedom, I don't need them. Where's your freedom? This one needs a brand new freedom. Weed and the key. Weed and the key them to life. Let's beat them. Weed them smartphones, don't beat them. Borders, what's up with that? Politics, what's up with that? Police shots, what's up with that? Identities, what's up with that? Your privilege, what's up with that? Broke people, what's up with that? Broke people, what's up with that? The realness, what's up with that? The new world, what's up with that? I'm gonna keep up on all that. Guns blows doors to the system. Yeah, fuck them when we say we're not with them. We're solid and we don't need to kick them. This is no Southeast and Western. Yeah, guns blows doors to the system. Yeah, fuck them when we say we're not with them. We're solid and we don't need to kick them. This is no Southeast and Western.
Bands Taco Cat and Sally Ford are co-headlining on Saturday, December 12th at the Cobalt. Doors open at 7 with the show starting at 8:30. This event is 19+. You can get your tickets today online at timberconcerts.com or at Red Cat and Zulu Records.
Need to talk? AMS Speakeasy offers free one-on-one, confidential, drop-in peer support sessions with trained volunteers. Our goal is to lend a listening ear and empower you to continue to strive towards wellness. Our services are available Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. during exam season. Support sessions can be requested at our desk on the main floor of the Nest or by ringing the doorbell outside our private space in room 3121. Learn more by visiting the AMS Speakeasy website. No issue is too big or too small. We're here to listen.
You are back with Lady Radio on CITR 101.9. Thank you, Marina and Callie, for that really insightful conversation about WAVA. I think it leads us well into our panel here about sexual assault on university campuses and how people are feeling unsafe. Just to contextualize a bit the conversation, given last week's event, I'd like to start with discussing a brief overview of what happened with six female victims of sexual abuse and their perpetrator, Dmitry Mordvinov. Dmitry was expelled after allegations were made against him for raping six graduate students while pursuing his PhD in history at UBC. Six women came forward to the school with their complaints against Dmitry, and little was done to help them. Finally, when the school was under enough fire to finally push the perpetrator, they expelled him. However, Dmitry is currently doing research in Russia, his home country, so the punishment appears ineffective and useless, in my opinion. And this is taken from the Fifth Estate's coverage of the investigation. School of Secrets was what the episode was called. So I think to start us off, a question I have is, or to contextualize the question first, there was a study done at UBC about how safe people are feeling on campus, and a statistic that was said was between 2009 and 2014, females felt less safe from 55% in 2009 to 30% in 2014. So why are students feeling less safe on university campuses? What's happening to make them feel that way?
Well, one thing could be the growing way that media coverage has addressed this issue. There's a lot of fear-mongering and a lot of focus on telling women that they should not walk alone and that they should do something about sexual assault, basically victim blaming and placing the onus on women. And I think this study definitely is valid to say that there is an increased level of fear, but I also think that the institutional space has never been a very safe place for women and never been a very safe place for racialized people or people with disabilities, people with different sexualities. And that's something to acknowledge, especially because we're also on Indigenous land, Musqueam land, and this is not a safe environment when it comes to violence. But I think there's been increased focus on like a number of uncovering of sexual assault cases that have happened at UBC, many of which were not acknowledged in the early stages of those cases, and therefore, I think a lot of women are feeling a lot of mistrust with the university on whether they will be there for them if this ever happens to them, and whether, like, reporting even does anything. And alongside of that, like, also becoming more and more conscious of the fact that, like, they are constantly surrounded by people that could hurt them. And the fact that perpetrators are existing among our student body and even among our staff is a scary thing to acknowledge. And I think a lot of students are really scared mm-hmm. to know what to do and know that people aren't going to be there for them if that happens. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a big part of that is like, I mean, we were talking about the space itself hasn't gotten more dangerous or less mm-hmm. dangerous. It's part of it is awareness because we're mm-hmm. talking about it now. And so people are thinking about it. And so, of course, they'd be more scared. Mm-hmm. But it's like also, I don't know, the whole like trying to figure it out by like an AMS survey, which like barely anyone actually mm-hmm. does anyway. Like they send them out through emails. And mm-hmm. I know, you know, a lot of my friends like just don't bother.
Yeah.
there's that conversation. It's like more people are willing to say they're scared, but like maybe part of it is they're also aware how, like becoming more aware at how little support they actually have. And like that's mm-hmm. a scary thing. Mm-hmm. Like it's just an alarming kind of place to be in, environment to be in. And it's, I think, more than just like their fear of someone popping out of the bushes is like,
yeah.
Which is something that is still being said on campus.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also that reporting, especially like 2 years ago, where we were having so many cases of like this stranger that was attacking people, was propagating a certain myth that is a lot of people don't understand about sexual assault, that 80% of sexual assault survivors mm-hmm. have known intimately their mm-hmm. Attacker. And this is deeply, like, the focus and attention on that was making people fearful to be in public spaces. I was even, like, nervous about, walking to the bus because everyone was like, don't ever walk alone at night. And, like, all of these things where you're just, like, you feel incredibly vulnerable. But we're vulnerable in many spaces in our lives, and that's not talked about to the same extent, and especially in, like, university dorms. We don't have enough of a extensive system of addressing sexual assault within dormitories, which is, like, majority of also victims of sexual assault are under 18, so mm-hmm. first-year students. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I'd just like to jump in on Elizabeth's point that, mm-hmm. like, these statistics can be very vague because we don't have a way of monitoring how things are being reported and investigated. And I know, Marina, you mentioned that before we were mm-hmm. coming into the studio, that these statistics aren't concrete. Like,
mm-hmm. And many of the statistics are coming from, like, police departments, too, which is something we can't rely on as well because those institutions inherently are violent as well. So many people don't feel that they can access them. So we really need to be careful about what statistics we use, but we do know that this is, like, a pervasive issue and it is disproportionately affecting young women.
One thing you said about, like, walking to the bus loop, mm-hmm. I was just, like, this was around the serial raper mm-hmm. time. I was just walking to my friend's dorm, like, at around midnight by myself, and it was kind of dark because it was, like, winter, and there were three guys walking, and I heard them saying to each other, they're like, she shouldn't be walking by herself so late at night. And I was like,
mm-hmm. oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
I think that brings up a really good point about how the onus is on women to prevent rape happening to them and abuse happening to them. And why aren't we talking more about how men can stop raping? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm using gendered terms for the purpose of this discussion, but a perpetrator can be of any gender and a victim can be of any gender. But how come the onus is on the victim to protect themselves?
I think a big question that kind of raises is, like, so much of what we see in terms of responses to sexual assault, both, like, off or on campus specifically and in general, is so much after the fact. And it's mm-hmm. so like, oh, this happened. Okay, so like, how can we deal with this now? And like, what are the processes for talking about it after? But like, there's almost no, I mean, the fact that we don't even have a policy in place. Like,
yeah.
if we're thinking about combating sexual assault, why isn't the first thing we're doing, like, mm-hmm. trying to get on it from the beginning and like making that a mandatory part of like initiation processes? Because we're putting students through required structured initiation, like, to the school things, and that's not part of it, and it could mm-hmm. easily be part of it.
Yeah,
like, why not start there instead of starting when it's too late?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have orientations in place, right?
Yeah,
it's happening in the States, and I don't know if it's happening in Canada yet, but there are two schools in the States that have this program called Get Explicit 101. That's an orientation for all incoming freshmen about bystander intervention, rape prevention, what you can do in an unsafe situation, how you can help someone out of situations. And I think that's awesome that we're talking about it there, but that's only two schools in the States yeah. that are doing it.
I also think an important thing is to start talking more about sex positivity and start acknowledging, like, instead of focusing just on violence once it has happened, focusing on how to navigate intimacy, because so many young people are coming into the university space having not had exposure to any like valid sexual health knowledge, not having exposure to talk about intimacy issues, not having exposure to talking about consent issues, and not really knowing how to navigate that and not knowing where to go to a safe place to learn about that. So it's a really difficult thing when those lines can become blurry because we're just, like, lost
and not having a good force of guiding people.
Yeah, I know that. I think on the lines of sexual intimacy, I think there's also sort of like a dating how to, or like, what are you in a dating situation that is like emotionally safe and physically safe? And, you know, because you, a lot of people, this is their first time moving mm-hmm. to a place where they don't have their parents, and they have, you know, acquaintances that they're trying to make into closer friends. And it can be kind of like a stepping onto this boat of like, who do I trust? Is this person trustworthy? Is this person like mm-hmm. Treating me respectfully and like keeping my boundaries in mind? Am I keeping their boundaries in mind? Am I asking too much? Are they asking, you know, I don't know. I think that can really help in terms of like keeping yourself healthy and in terms of like dating violence and stuff like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point too, that elicits what is upholding rape culture. And there are a lot of expectations and behavioral manners in dating and dating culture that can uphold rape culture. I mean, you tend to hear that like sex is expected on the first date and things like that, that put people in harm, I find.
Mm-hmm. And also like teaching people about the like systemic issue of sexual assault, because like as much as we're talking about sex positivity, I also want to clarify that like sexual assault is not about sex. It's about power. It's about power differentiation. So like, yes, we can mitigate sexual abuse to happen in intimate relationships when we know more about how to navigate those intimate relationships. But we also know that like this is a widespread issue because we have power differentiation, and that's why we see more women having a larger number of sexual assaults, because there still is a sexist system in place and we still are vulnerable to violences more than men are. And that goes the same way when we're talking about racialized people or people of lower class or people coming from different countries, immigrants, like especially when talking about Syrian refugees coming into the world. These are vulnerable populations, people with disabilities. So it's a power issue. So understanding what that power system is and deconstructing that, I think that every single first year should have like a 101 like systems of oppression class. Mm-hmm. And it's like really, really scary that that is not required.
Yeah, and that actually leads me into another question I wanted to ask, which is what is the school's responsibility in dealing with this? Anyone?
No? Well, I guess that's a good question, because I was thinking about that a lot watching The Hunting Ground yesterday, because there's so much, I mean, not that I'm saying it shouldn't be there, but it was very clearly like, they did this and you did not respond as an institution. And I think, I mean, my feelings about how involved or like what responsibility the school has goes so much to like the whole, like, if the purpose of university is to create this sort of like intellectual space where people are thriving, and it's supposed to be about community, and it's supposed to be, you know, whether or not it is, that's one thing, but like if that's the message that we're putting forward and that's like the original ideas of this institution, that it's this supportive place of learning, that like you're not just coming in and going out, but you're coming in and like adding to it and thriving and everything, like if that is truly what we're going to say the university is, which is questionable, I think then that responsibility entirely falls on them. If it's like, hey, we're coming here and you have these codes of conduct in place and this is maybe the only resource I can go to that will say this is against our code of conduct, and that's a body that you have access to as a member of that community, and then trying to access it and then being like, actually, like, that's our code of conduct, but like we kind of have other priorities, mm-hmm. so don't worry about it, is getting away from, you know, what the image that they're protecting is about a university being this certain place, that like that is just, it becomes a lie.
Yeah, and it's a really backwards way of looking at it, I think, like universities trying to shove all this information and these complaints under the rug because they're trying to save face and save their reputation, where I think if they start addressing it, it'll actually give them a good reputation of being a support and being helpful to the students and actually listening and being there and caring for them.
And like changing something about these attitudes that are so harmful. Mm-hmm. Like that's way better of a contribution you can make.
The thing is that it's like the university functions as a corporation. So it's just like basically bad exposure means like their value, their corporate value goes down. And so like that's inherently what the issue is with like the way they address anything, mm-hmm. basically. But especially with like something as like vulnerable as sexual assault, where it gives a bad rap for the university and everything like that, ultimately what we've been hearing, especially from like last week and what's been exposed, is that like people were told like to shut up, basically, that they needed to they had to prove themselves first before this could be something that was addressed. And also the fact that we don't have a policy that says that perpetrators automatically, when the like allegation is put out, have to leave the campus. That is ridiculous to me. The fact that you can expose other people to their violence and also like expose the survivor to interacting with their perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And this was someone who was employed by the university too in the history department. So like that is a huge issue, and it's not a singular case. The fact that this is only being talked about now is just a reflection of how much silencing goes on.
Yeah, and there is this really interesting discourse that happens on university campuses to uphold this image of, we are here to guide you through your experience, your career. We are here to care for you from start to finish. And where does that care fall through when situations like this arise? Mm-hmm. There was a quote in, I believe it was The Hunting Ground. I'm just trying to look for it now, but this girl saying that she felt so cared for by her university until she had to be cared for. I don't know if you remember exactly what it was, Elizabeth. Yeah. It was pretty powerful.
I think that was almost it verbatim. Just that the university puts forward this image of, like, you know, it's a place of learning, it's a place of support. Mm-hmm. And like this rhetoric of like, we take these things very seriously. Mm-hmm. Like they mentioned that in the documentary, like that was just the repeated rhetoric of every single university's like formal statement. And last night I was reading the UBC article about that, and it's the same language as, we take these very seriously. Mm-hmm. And like, they're just, that's, you know, you take it really seriously, like that's great, but when people are actually going to for it, like you're not showing that happening. Mm-hmm. It's not evident.
And also the fact that like there are so many like, I think, I can't remember the exact details, but if anyone reported to, like, a department head, for example, about this experience, we don't have department heads or, like, training among administration that, like, tells them what to do in those scenarios. Because you could say something wrong because you're not knowledgeable. You could end up further, like, victimizing the survivor and putting them in a vulnerable situation. You could not know how to approach this, which is, like, we don't have an institutional approach that says, like, this is what you do in these scenarios, and this is what you should also be, like, how you should make someone feel incredibly safe, like emotional support training. Like, nobody has exposure to that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most shocking things that I saw in the documentary, and I think as well with the Fifth Estate, was people tied to a lot of these cases, it ended up being a conflict of interest. There was a case happening at Florida State University where the victim brought on a detective, contacted the president. There was the chief of police that was there. And the detective and chief of police were both FSU alums. So there's kind of this conflict of interest where they had been donating money to the university, and they didn't want to give the university a bad rep by taking on her case. There was just kind of this weird, vague conflict of interest that was happening. Which becomes a major problem.
And also, it's not comforting to know that, like, as a survivor, your options are very limited in terms of how you seek justice, and the criminal justice system notoriously does not bring people accountable for their actions. And if we also have a university system that doesn't bring people accountable, every institution is avoiding holding perpetrators accountable, you start to lose faith and lose faith in choosing those roads of justice, which is fine because there are other forms of justice, but the fact that this is not an option at all, there are many different like avenues of justice, but you need to be able to have all of those avenues open to you as a survivor.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about what those options would look like. Like, what do you think would be good to have available on campus for victims to pursue this kind of justice to their perpetrator?
Yeah. Well, I know the Women's Center has been doing a lot of conversations on campus about having a support group. So having things like that, emotional support as being an option, having well-trained staff that understand, like, how to be emotional support, seeking justice through I don't know, having creative outlets, things like that, or like having or contributing towards like anti-rape culture work or something like that. I don't know. Does anybody else have any other ideas?
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, I think there just needs to be a system that everybody knows about, that there's, here's exactly what happens when you make a claim. Here's where you go. There's a safe space to do it. Here's what I'm going to do. And it's going to happen for every woman who, or person who wants to come in and talk about it. And like, here's how we're going to look into the claim. Mm-hmm. Here's how you're going to feel safe. You know, I just think that if we can, like, make it into machination as much as possible, then that's how people can start trusting again, as you're saying, like, mm-hmm. having a trust in a system that's going to work for them.
Also, it's very difficult to find out, like, online what, like, UBC does when a claim like this comes in. We don't have a policy, so therefore, like, there's no easy way to look up and be like, okay, so if I put in a claim, I know that the university will do A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. Like, we have no knowledge of that, so... Like, obviously, people are scared to put in a claim when they don't know what they're going to be faced with, and especially when they know from media sources that this has not been a safe process. So having those, like, clearly defined ways of addressing the issue and clearly defined resources for someone facing these things is, like, a number one priority.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's not just students who are afraid to speak up against the institution. What happened with this case with Dimitri was that, I believe his name was Paul Kraus, a professor in the Department of History, actually spoke up against the case mm-hmm. and was kind of punished for that, was kind of silenced and swept under the rug. I don't know, there was an article about it, and so wow. he was afraid to speak up on it mm-hmm. because it affected his reputation within the department. Exactly. So you don't just have students, you have faculty members, you have administration.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're systemic. Not tenured either, like, if you're not, like, covered by the university, you could be fired or you could, like, you're in a vulnerable situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul talks a bit about that in his article. And for anyone who's listening who wants to check that out, it was published in the Talon back in March. The SASC did post it on their page yesterday before the Hunting Ground screening. It references the Hunting Ground because it just came out. We can post that on our Facebook later for you all to check out. But one thing that I think is really interesting, and I was talking to Zoe about this before, is that in the article he mentions that the UBC refused to publish that article, and it was coming out in the Talon, and he made a comment at the end, like, you know, where, like, UBC, why are you not stepping up and publishing this? Like, what's the problem there? And it's just interesting to see in the aftermath of all of this, like, they've published it and it's like front page news in the current edition of the UBC. But what they cover and what they say is, like, the CVC said this in the Fifth Estate, and they don't say that they are saying it or, like, mm-hmm. agreeing with the story or whatever, which, I was saying, like, it might be a move of journalistic kind of, like, neutrality?
There's objectivity? No such thing, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm kind of surprised to see that from the UBC because I haven't noticed them before, like, shying away from, you know, some serious shit, like, let's say it that way. And I was kind of surprised to see that. It's like they're not even taking it on as, like, this is what's happening. They're like, this is what it says in the CBC.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Well, a lot of people are really scared to talk about sexual assault. And a lot of that comes from fear and ignorance and the way that sexual assault has been framed mm-hmm. for certain people, or the fact that they've never talked about it before, or they don't know how to approach it. And that's a huge, like, systemic issue on campus. And that's not just that because that fear and ignorance exists within the institutional space, it affects everyone who comes through the institutional space. So other students are not going to be able to talk about this. And, like, providing workshops, for example, that allow people to use the language to name things, mm-hmm. like, just referencing the first song that we, like, listened to when we opened up the show tonight is called Does It Still Count by The Oz. And that is particularly addressing the fact that as a survivor, you don't even have the language to describe what you've experienced, or you don't know that you have experienced sexual assault because you've never been told, like, where lines of consent are, like, where, like, are you responsible? And because there's so much victim blaming, it's hard to, like, identify that within yourself and identify that experience. So, like, having literacy around that is such a huge issue, especially within a university campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that might be all the time we have. Unfortunately, I hate to cut that off, but yeah, we're just running out.
Yeah, thank you guys for discussing today. I definitely had more questions, but it's nice that we got to delve deep into a few of them. So, yeah, thank you for listening in. This was Lady Radio Show at CITR 101.9.
And just to mention a couple events that are coming up, tonight is Femme Fridays at the Norm, and I know Lady Radio or Dora Duber is going to be there, or Dora Duber. Dora Duber, we had this one conversation last time. She's going to be there. They are playing Tank Girl at 7 and Ghost World at 9, and they are also having an interview with the director of Tank Girl following the screening, so go check that out if you are looking for something to do tonight. Also, next week on Monday, the Women's Center is hosting a screening and panel of Highway of Tears, which I think, do we have a little information about Highway of Tears, what it's about?
It's talking about the Highway of Tears in northern BC, which is talking about missing and murdered Aboriginal women and the disproportionate effects of violence against Aboriginal women within Canada.
So we will be sharing the link to that event on our Facebook page, but if you want to check that out, that's Monday at the Norm. The panelists are Faye Blaney, Summer Rain, Elm Maya, Tail Feathers, apologies that I probably ruined that pronunciation, and Audrey Siegel. So definitely go check that out if you can.
I just have one more thing to add, just as kind of a wrap-up to this conversation. The biggest kind of takeaway is allyship to people who have undergone this kind of trauma. You can help by listening. You can help by helping them, taking them to resources and getting help within the institution and different areas that they can get feel healed by. But it's very important to listen to someone who is willing to share their story with you, because it's really hard for them to do that.
Mm-hmm. And also I should note, so coming up right after this, we're going to have a broadcast by UBC Insiders, and they are featuring an interview with two of the women who were featured in the CBC documentary. That is Caitlin Cunningham and Caitlin Russell, two Caitlins. So that's coming up right after this, so stay tuned, and we'll be finishing off with a bit of Dilly Dally. This song is called Purple Rage. This has been Lady Radio, CITR 101.9. We'll be right back.
FM Vancouver Reloaded, playing your favorite tunes and mouth-humping your ear holes full of voice talk. Yeah, we do that.
Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of November 27th, 2015, the show that brings you inside